because Zed actually means zeal. It means what zeal means without L. And it means excess. Shakespeare says of it, thou horse bed, thou unnecessary matter. Zed means zeal, and zeal means excessive energy applied to something. And it says of Christ, when he whipped the moneylenders out of the temple, the zeal of the house. Obviously, he couldn't have eaten up the infinite divinity of him. He must have eaten up the finite humanity of him. He was driven by zeal, that is, by excess energy directed towards the witness of God's purpose in the temple to flog human beings out of their place of worship. And this was excessive. Nevertheless, we have a good reason why he did it. Because when he went to John the Baptist and asked John the Baptist to baptize him, and John the Baptist refused because he was an inferior kind of fellow compared with Christ, according to that kind of shoe. Where? Jesus said to him, do it, for thus it becomes to fulfill all righteousness, that the superior shall be baptized by the inferior occasionally, just to show that we don't leave anything out. John the Baptist means John the intellect, baptism, immersion in water, water, material experience, the intellect immersed in material experience. Intellect does not mean the ideational level of the common sense man. It means logos consciousness. The cosmic logos is going to immerse itself in the material world. And this is a necessary part of its process in order to fulfill all righteousness. Funny enough that the word translated right in the New Testament in the Greek is derived from the ousia root, which means being. One is right and one is being oneself. One is wrong when one is adulterated by something other than oneself. To be properly oneself is to be right. Right, we translate into Latin the property, proprium, own, that which is really one's own. But it's nothing really one's own except oneself and one's necessary attributes, and this is being right. So in order to be right, one must go through all the phases of one's being. Go through all the phases means not to leave any out. And one of the possibilities can be is excessive action. By excessive action, as William Blake pointed out, one learns what is enough. You can't know what is enough until you know what excess is. Because if you take the baby drinking milk, he can't puke until he is rather overfed. And if he doesn't puke, he will never understand the principle of puking. So he will never really understand the whole alphabet, and therefore he ought to puke. And this he can only do properly by being a little excessive in his intake. And this is the meaning of the letter Z. It means excess in any field whatever. And although it is unnecessary, that is to say, excess is not necessary for any given job, by definition, because that which is necessary for a given job is neither more nor less energy than needed. Whereas more than that is unnecessary, and therefore Z is said to be an unnecessary letter. Nevertheless, although it is a bad thing, it is a good thing to know what it is. Because by means of excess and careful watching where excess begins, one discovers the limit of enoughness. So when Christ goes into the temple and starts flogging them, he is doing an excessive act. And he's doing it because God himself says to fulfill all righteousness, you should do something wrong in order to understand the limit of right. And he goes in and he does a wrong act. That is to say, he applies physical violence in the world, which he's later to condemn as being the method of this world. He says later, if this were my kingdom, then would my servants fight. and he has himself used this violence in the temple, and militaries ever since have said to pacifists, but didn't Jesus use violence to drive out the enemies of God in the temple? Therefore you should fight. Now they're using a demonstration of excess to justify excess. But if there were no such excess to use, people would be unclear about what was enough. Christ was the occasion whereby the Spanish Inquisition occurred. Should he therefore not act? If there had been no Christ, there would have been no Spanish Inquisition. And in his infinite wisdom, he knew that people would, in his name, commit abominable crimes. Should he therefore go out of existence? And in the same way, should he not have demonstrated what zeal could do under a very special situation where he is defending God, and he's so determined to defend God that he uses excessive energy and throws people, saying on this occasion the defense of God is so terribly important that zeal, excessive energy, tends to appear. And now look what I've done. I've flogged out all these innocent twisters, the money lenders of company, and that is the kind of thing that the love of God will make you do if you're not careful. I've shown you what it can do. The Spanish Inquisition is exactly the same thing. And he knew that that could happen, and yet he made no guard against it. Why not? Thus it becomes to fulfill all righteousness. That is to say, he knew very well that the human race would have to go through terrible times before it can be driven into reflexive self-awareness. He said sorrow must come. Woe to him by whom? When he brought sorrow, he was crucified. Woe to him by whom? Everybody who brings sorrow will have reflexively woe back on them. Every excessive act will beget an excessive act. By driving the money lenders out of the temple by excessive action, he provoked the rabbis into excessive retort. They crucified him. If he'd have descended to the level of nuns over such activity at that point and debated with the money lenders their right to be there, there would have been an interminable argument. And he would not have annoyed the rabbis sufficiently for them to crucify him. And he had to move towards the cross. He steadfastly set his face towards Jerusalem. It is not a statement to be excessive all the time, as often as possible. And if anybody thought it was, it wouldn't do them much harm, because you haven't that much energy. If you're very excessive one day, you won't have the energy to be so the next day. There's one thing about excess, it does teach you the limits of your individual capacity for excess. So excess in that sense is not a very bad thing, because it's educational. A man told me he had misbehaved himself 18 times in one night. When I questioned him about the details of the performance, it turned out that he hadn't done any such thing. He'd only tried to misbehave himself, and he hadn't got enough energy. What he was annoyed about was that he had not been able to misbehave himself 18 times. He hadn't got enough energy. He was worrying about his impotence, not about his performance of wickedness. And anybody who tries, with all the energy they've got, to be excessive, will soon discover the limits of their power to excess. So it isn't such a bad thing after all. As Jacob Wilhelm said, the worst is as good as the best. And the unnecessary zeal is as good as the best control, because it sharpens the awareness of control by running over the limit and allowing you to see what will happen to you if you haven't got control. And without this demonstration, you would never know. Supposing God, in his infinite mercy, had made a special device that automatically compensated for every human excess, so that whatever human beings did, God immediately by his infinite power contradicted the error, corrected it. Man would never know what he had done. Couldn't possibly know, and therefore he could not evolve towards reflexive self-consciousness. Therefore he could not be a fitting reciprocal subject in relation with God. So he must have these limiting factors, and he must be zealous, and he must overdo things, and he must get his knuckles wrapped, and he must have pain, etc., and he must think about it. This is must, this is M-U-S-T, this is moo, this is his substantial appetite for self-crucifixion driving him along, because without it he will never attain self-knowledge. If anybody becomes afraid and thinks this is a recommendation for wickedness, let them see whether any people have sufficient memory to bother to remember it, to commit the excesses in the name of this permission.
Whose self-knowledge was he helping along in the temple? Is there more somebody else's or less than one of us?
It says the zeal of the house. He's thinking about God's temple and its proper use, and he says, it is written that this house should be a house of prayer, and you have made it a den of thieves. The context says that he is contemplating the real purpose of this temple and what has actually happened to it. And as he contemplates the discrepancy between using it as a house of merchandise and using it as a house of prayer, the opposition God and Mammon comes into his mind, and he sees man misdirected towards Mammon, and at this point the energy used in the contemplation is so great he turns out and wallops lost. Who gets the benefit? Obviously he did, and so did everybody else. We have to remember that Jesus in the Bible is represented consistently as a human being. He's a baby, he's got to be carted about by his mummy. Afterwards he goes away and he's rather inconsiderate. He goes arguing with old men and defeating them on points of logic. He refuses to go with his mother, and then he's persuaded to go. He submits himself. He's growing in wisdom, he's growing in stature. He's hungering, he's thirsting, he's being tired. He's saying, let the cup pass from me in the garden, and so on. He's doing all these things. So he's a human being, and therefore he has to represent the human being in every aspect. Supposing he'd never shown this zeal, everybody would say of him, well, he wasn't human. He never lost his temper once. But we say, he did once. He lost his temper, because temper means balance, and zeal means excess. So at that moment he lost his balance, but in the name of God. And it says, a human being in pursuing the good may be excessive sometimes. It doesn't mean that excess is right, but it does mean that it's likely to occur in the pursuit of an aim. And he shows what a human being can do. And then he shows that one can combat this element and become not merely human but divine. But right until the resurrection and the transfiguration, there is still some doubt about whether he's done it. Thomas still has to put his fingers in the holes to prove that this is really the power and not another power. And all these are necessary stages in the evolution of human beings. The story of Christ's life is the story of the evolution from a human baby through to God. And everything he does is part of the story. So that if you take the very worst things that he's credited with, they're parts of the phases of the human development. And if you take the best things he did, the fact of affirming the cross, which is his best thing, and going to hell, and resurrecting and being transfigured, these things are also possible for human beings. Whereas if he had never done these other things, these excesses and so on, these doubts, such as Salem and Gethsemane, if he'd never done these things, nobody would believe him. They'd say he did not suffer. There's a heresy that says that Christ did not suffer. That being on the cross was not God, it was an illusion. That the infinite God can't suffer pain, therefore it was an illusion. Therefore no man suffered for us. This is a heresy. He says he can't participate because he never did suffer. It was an illusion, a fabrication of the Almighty to dupe us. It's a heresy. It's an error. In somebody's opinion, and it's not a right opinion. Because if he did not suffer like we do, then he knows nothing whatever about what we're talking about. And if he doesn't know what we're talking about, then certainly he can be no Messiah to us. Because it is we who want saving, not some hypothetical beings.
Is there a connection between the S and the Z?
Yes. S and the Z differ only in this. Z is voice and S is not voiced. They're both pronounced in exactly the same position. One of them you can whisper, the other you cannot. You can whisper S, you cannot whisper Z. So you have to voice it. This tells you that this S, this spirit, in the material world, causing the material world to buzz, that is to give evidence of its working, that is to betray that it is at work, is excess. This secret work, this unvoiced work, this non-self-betraying work, is the way God works. You can't hear, unless you've got very sharp ears, trees growing in the seed. You can hear grass sucking sap on a nice day. If you get down and listen very carefully to grass, you can hear it going. But you can't hear it in the seed making up its mind to shoot. And efficiency means no noise. The efficiency of a motor car engine is about 42%. Something about that. The rest is wasted in friction and noise. And the whole pursuit of science is to make a machine that makes no noise and has no friction. But that which has no noise and no friction is non-existent. That would be perpetual motion, a non-frictive machine. Now God, by his infinity and absoluteness, is silent. Because he's silent, he's efficient. And the soundless that he makes, which can't be heard because even whispered is frictive for us. But that's, which hasn't got any sound in it at all, but he's still saying, he's still separating. And separation is another aspect of creation. That is all right. And if you want to soften it some more, you say, shh. But as soon as you put the M sound on it, the sound of substance, it goes zzz. And then you feel it to be excessive because it is giving away that it is working. It's equivalent to you letting your right hand know what your left hand is doing. If people can tell what you are up to, you are excessive. It's very important. If you're in relation with another being and the other person knows what you are doing, you are excessive.
The average ambassador
plant,
have you got,
like? Yes, it's on the way.
I'm sorry to come back to this point again, but isn't zeal, therefore, by definition, a missing of the immediate mark? Whereas it's going beyond the mark.
Sin means to miss the mark. Now, in order to hit the mark, one must fulfill all righteousness. Therefore, zeal is a stage on the way to hitting the mark. Zeal is nothing. It is a stage on the way. Because only the full, self-aware man, aware of all his capacities, can hit the mark. And to do this, he must have had zeal. At some point in his life, he must have grabbed somebody without permission and plonked a large kiss on her red nose and got away with it by sudden attack by zeal. If he doesn't do any such thing, well, he's just not going to know what could be effective at any given moment. He couldn't possibly know what a joyous thing a fat accomplice is.
Well, would it not be fair, similarly, to allow the conduct of Eichmann on ground zero.
Providing it were true that it was on ground zero, yes. Supposing Eichmann had never been zealous before and said, "My dear sirs, I was approaching the grain and I have not yet been zealous, and here was my opportunity, and without it my evolution could not be complete. Therefore I turned 5 million Jews into soap. And this is my one act of zeal. I now relinquish zeal. My evolution is complete. And this moment, if we were telling the truth, we'd say, 'Well, we'll have to forgive you.' Actually, you'd be shining so brightly that you need a veil before his face like Moses. We can't truthfully attribute this to Eichmann. He looked worried in the box. And it's not the only occasion he's been zealous. And we don't need to be zealous more than enough time to make us realise what zeal is.
Excessive zeal.
You say that Zen Buddhists are zealous people. Does the Zen have a significance there?
Yes. When a Zen archer stands with his bow taut, he's using a tension process, an excess process, to find the point of release. Without that tension, it wouldn't happen. You have to hold it and wait and wait and wait until you think, "Well, surely nothing will happen now." And the precise moment where you are sure nothing will happen, something happens. But not if you give up before. There are points in the most intimate relationships where you could wait excessively. Just go on waiting and waiting and waiting. See what excessive waiting is like. At a certain point, somebody says a rude word, because you're waiting. And that's broken the ice. Suddenly there is a relation there. The power of waiting is tremendous. It's the whole meaning of the Tao Te Ching, the valley deep. Supposing there's a man and his wife in bed, you assume they're legitimately married for them. And she's practicing waiting and she hasn't told him. She's practicing waiting and she hasn't told him. And she's doing it deliberately and she's behaving like M3. That is, like the Virgin Mary after the Annunciation. She's waiting for the Spirit. And she's deliberately and consciously waiting for the Spirit. But she hasn't told him what she's doing. Now, if she's doing it properly and sincerely, at a certain point she'll become aware that she's waiting. You won't know what for, but she's waiting. The next thing is that because he's not doing this particular exercise, as defined in this example, he's not doing it, therefore he will egotistically interpret that she's waiting for him. And she hasn't said so. And he must then proceed to identify with that which fulfills what she's waiting for. He assumes unconsciously the role of Holy Ghost. If she's that up, if she can wait that long without saying, "Hey, I've been waiting, do my exercise, and you haven't responded, you twat," or something of that order. The power of waiting is tremendous. If you don't say what you do, create a void and nature abhors it. If your dear friend is about, you'll try to fill it. Somebody will speak if nobody will speak. Jesus said, "If I do not speak, the very stones will cry out." Why will they? Because nature abhors a vacuum. If nobody speaks, somebody will have to speak. Because there could be such a thing as excess silence. It's a device. Everything can be used and avenue. When the Tao Te Ching is talking about the method, in the right translation, of course, the method of woman, she conquers by silence. Certainly she will never conquer by nettle. By silence she will conquer. Because of the profound egotism of habit. If she's silent for long enough, in a good mood, you can't think what's the matter. Has the lodger been round? Has she a new boyfriend? Why is she present? She's not complaining. Somebody must have given her something. Who is it? What is it? Is it something I could have given to her without involving myself in the relation? all these things must occur in his mind because she is creating a void and he must fill it, provided he doesn't know the rule. And so few people know the rule. You mean that's a technique?
This one?
Has a technique, it's suspicious.
No, the chastity is found that it's suspicious of all the thoughts passing through his mind.
Well, that's the natural mechanical thoughts of any man when he sees a woman smiling.
I think it's a widely used technique, whether they do it consciously or unconsciously.
Certainly, it's a widely used technique, but it's also a widely abused technique, and both of them unconsciously. Certainly not verbally formed. There's a lot of it, but not with great clarity. And they tend to become exhausted too soon. And say, look, I've been practicing in quiet for your sake, and you haven't said anything yet. They break it because they're not sure what they ought to do. If only they could persist, then everything would happen in a different way.
And there's a little variation on solitary confinement.
Yes, yes, selling into Coventry. As you know, who lived in Coventry, a lady on a horse. Killing to Coventry. Well, the pun is obvious on the word. It means cover the entrance, doesn't it? So it's telling you that whatever he wants to get, you put a veil on it. Now, is it fair? How do men get sent to Coventry? They oppose the social body, don't they? Why are they doing it? For the highest reasons? If so, they don't mind being sent to Coventry. For less than the highest, and they'll complain, and they will have to choose whether they're going to belong to the body corporate social or God. It's an occasion of choice again. It's not so bad. I've been sent to Coventry many times. I've always taken my knitting with me. It's an occasion of choice.
Yes, I suppose it wouldn't be because there's silence within it.
Very valuable
thing. It is,
yes. Someone else is going to help. Yes. I asked a fellow to do an exercise and had a wife who nagged him perpetually. And he was in the habit of sulking silently and not replying. In other words, he'd been quite negative. I asked him, instead of being negatively silent, to be positively silent and set himself any kind of mental exercise. Whether it was simply mentally adding up sums or squaring circles or thinking how many pounds of bananas you can get for 1 and 4 pence in 1937, whatever it was, but to occupy his mind with something instead of the sulking. Now, as soon as he did this exercise, the wife became aware there was a qualitative change in his silence. She looked at him. She became silent. She went to the kitchen. She returned. Slightly different technique. Eventually she had to upset a cup of tea on him. There was something going wrong with the technique. This caught him off guard, he hadn't bargained for it, and he lapsed into sulks again. Later on, considering it, he discovered that if he'd have taken the cup of tea with equanimity, she'd have had to find another thing, perhaps the fire irons or that. Certainly she'll have to find something. And if his patience is greater than hers, he will win. And if it isn't, she will, because life is like that.
Okay. Wouldn't you recommend Shakespeare's method of being happy?
I have on occasion recommended such, but it has to be a very specific occasion and it must be recommended to the right man. You might recommend it to a man who might immediately get walloped by a very tough wife. There are no things you can recommend indiscriminately to everybody at all times. A very good exercise for the coming week. Find and define carefully one act of zeal and perform it. One act of excessive energy application, deliberately and consciously defined and performed. by accepting, by means accepting, carry it as far as you can. Don't wait for reaction, do it deliberately. Define it before the situation can arise, go out and create the situation and do it. If it's an act of excess, like murdering somebody,
of course. Well,
it doesn't matter, you'll learn, you see. This will tell you what kind of person you are by the kind of zealous act you define. Mm. If you define murder, for instance, you know it's highly probable people will be chasing you about. And you'll understand from that the type of reaction that kind of zealous activity begets. If you've pinched a baby's dolly mixtures, that's another one. Everything has a specific reaction. And until you define your act of zeal, you will not know whether you're ready to accept the consequences. Find yourself a local cathedral, go into it, plug the local bishop, tell him he's collecting cash and chanting God's temple into a house of cash, and see what happens. It's a waste of time, actually, because you know very well it's been done before. If you want to do a really zealous act for the best benefit, make it a new one, a unique act.
Have you?
Well, if you have really, so you don't need to do this exercise. But there's quite a difference between accidental zeal plus miserable repentance and deliberate zeal to see the consequences of deliberate zeal. Deliberate zeal has a different effect from accidental miserable zeal.
Harking back to Sahan's again, with what sense do we distinguish between companionable silence and oppressive silence? I think most of us, all of us, can distinguish between them.
By feeling. You've now the method. Are you feeling at one with the person that you're ignoring or not? If you are, you've got human underneath, you're ignoring them.
I also think one can distinguish it in strange in a strange room, strange people. One can find a companionable silence or an oppressive silence.
That depends on your feeling. Mm-hmm. You can be perfectly silent and feel in a certain way, and perfect strangers will think it's alright. They'll think you're a nice, silent person. And you can be silent in another way and think you're a horrid, silent person. Mm-hmm. That depends on your feeling, and your feeling is transmitting to the field forces that reciprocally act between you, and you can't stop them. Your feeling is something that will betray you. Feeling can come out on the tone to the ear very easily, and feeling can come out of the organism simply at the field level. Of field forces transmit and then get funny feelings. People may not be able to verbally articulate what they are, but they do feel them. And the qualities of silence, whether this is a good-willed silence or an evil silence, will transmit. You need never be afraid of being silent with strangers on the grounds of being misinterpreted. If you're feeling all right, they won't misinterpret. Feeling control is the subtlest, the hardest of all the controls.
It's immediate. Before the mechanism of control can be brought to play.
It's immediate. Because verbalization can only lag behind it. You can only say what you have just felt. The feeling is immediate. That's why it's hard to control.
Well, isn't it
fear that they help? That's retrospective, isn't it? You're talking about earlier feelings and your meditation upon them.
Yes.
But your present feeling is only articulated after the act. Because at the moment you start to speak, that feeling is fled. You mean gathering of yourself together to speak, or to speak? Feeling is causative in the sense, feeling is awareness of the field of power that you are. And your attitude towards another person is the attitude of the field forces which you are. And it responds immediately to you, because it is you. And as all verbalized expression of that fact is after the fact of the feeling. It's easy to say I love you, but it's quite another thing to mean it. On the feeling level. Very, very hard. Not many people manage to do it without an ulterior motive. Define it beforehand,
yeah.
And then deliberately commit it.
What happens if having defined it, because they're not the sort of things for consequences which you would know must necessarily flow from it?
And then you've evaluated yourself, haven't you? You've just evaluated yourself. You say, well, I'm not quite ready to accept all the things that follow from that act of zeal. I'll define myself an easier zealous act.
You have to define what you think is best to follow on as well.
Well, it depends whether you want to learn your lesson before or after the fact.
Well, surely if you want to learn it before, what's the point of doing the act?
Well, you can find out whether your calculation about what would happen is correct. It may not be. I seem to remember this is an exercise about going up to a policeman and saying, is it true that if I want to know the time, I should ask you? And screw yourself to the point of beginning to say that with a straight face. It's quite a simple exercise, but it isn't easy. No.